Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, Chair of the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum. And it's my pleasure to introduce Catherine Gundling, Head of the Clinical Programs at UCSF in Allergy and Immunology, who will then introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Homer Boucher.
Thank you, Bill. Good afternoon. Thank you for coming on this warm afternoon, although it's actually fairly nice in the room, isn't it? It's a distinct privilege for me to introduce Homer Boucher. He is a remarkable man. And I say that not just because he's officially my boss, and not just because he is beloved to many friends and family, but he has had a remarkable career. And for the past 5 years, it's been my privilege to work with Homer at UCSF. Homer's working life has been devoted to our understanding of asthma. That journey has taken him many places, including Stanford University, UCSF, some college in Boston, Oxford, a variety of places. But fortunately for all of us, he wound up back at UCSF, where he's spent his career helping us and really the world to understand asthma. Much of the time has been spent trying to determine what is asthma, what are these manifestations of the problems that small children and even older adults have with breathing or wheezing. What is it? Where does it come from? Why do people have it? Why do some people get it and some not? Much of the work that that Homer has done has pertained to treatment of asthma. How can people lead a normal quality of life in spite of the fact that they have asthma? But as he has gotten older, he has also gotten bolder. And now he's looking into the holy grail of asthma, which is, what is asthma? What is the ultimate cause of it? And this brings him to infectious diseases, which ultimately, as we all know, really are just immunologic disorders. I have to say that since I'm an immunologist. And in this work, Homer has startled the medical community with many of his hypotheses about the role of infection in asthma. He's going to talk with us tonight about what he thinks, what we see from the data, the science, and what he thinks we might learn in the future, and also what you and I might be able to do to protect ourselves and our families from developing asthma and related lung diseases. So here's Homer Boucher.
Thank you, Catherine. Now, you're right. I have worked on developing treatments for asthma, and I've been frustrated by that. Asthma is one of those diseases we can treat, but we cannot cure. The best therapies we have are controllers, which means if you stop taking them within a few months, you might as well never have taken them. And that's been shown repeatedly. And asthma is increasing in prevalence throughout the world, especially in the developing world. And we don't know why. And we have no idea how to prevent it. So if I've been bold, it's because I've been frustrated. And I think we do need better tools for preventing asthma. And that depends on our understanding it. Now, Bill Grant told me I really had to finish within an hour. So I have to keep my – I'll show you my program for the evening, which is pared down. This is part of the Commonwealth's Club Now and Then lecture series. Its official subtopic is microbes and chronic diseases, so I'm discussing asthma as an example of a chronic disease. And I believe that searching for microbes by genetic signature, not by the old methods of culture, is going to transform medicine in the same way that our definition of the human genome is going to transform our ideas of medicine. So I believe these tools will stimulate the second genome revolution, the first being that stimulated by the definition or decoding of the human genome. Now, human genome. Talks usually end with thanks. I'm going to start with one. These are the people, this is a small fraction of the people whom I've leaned on for the work we've done. The clinical work, the studies of viruses, the bacterial studies. Susan Lynch and Owen Brody, incidentally, are one of those wonderful husband-wife teams where the wife works at UCSF and the husband at Lawrence Berkeley National Labs, and together are a fabulous, well, marital, but also scientific partnership that I've benefited from. Yvonne Wang is the fellow post-resident training in pulmonary medicine who's done a lot of the work I'm going to describe. And I have to thank the people who help fund this work, principally the National Institutes of Health, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, the Sandler Family Foundation, and some anonymous donors, particularly who support for their support of Yvonne Wang. So the Now and Then lecture series was supposed to be reviewing the important changes in American life and culture since World War II. This was aimed at boomers, this theme, and we were to compare what we understood about events or facts in American life in 1960 to now, 50 years later, and then to extrapolate the change over the next 10 years and to discuss what these changes have meant to the people who've lived through the period and American culture more broadly. So I had to keep this short. So I want to start off with a review of the history of medicine, and then a section on the recognition and, in quotes intentionally, conquest of infectious disease, because I don't think these diseases are nearly as conquered as we've told ourselves. And the reason they aren't as conquered is because our methods for finding microbes are so limited. Then I talk to you about new methods. I need to give you a primer of molecular biology. And then using that information, we'll describe to you how we use microarrays to find microbes, and then demonstrate how we apply those to study of chronic disease, particularly asthma, which will then lead me to study intestinal flora, immune function, and health. So in a way, this talk is going to interface with the talk on from the Osler Foundation, Don Abrams' talk, and with David Kessler's talks on how the foods we eat may be altering our health through a pathway that might not be the first ones they suggest. Okay, Homeric view of the history of medicine. It's in three phases. Phase one is unfriendly nature. Phase two is bad habits. And phase three, to quote Walt Kelly, is we have met the enemy and they are us. All right. So the biggest and longest period is from when we defined ourselves as a separate branch of the primates, 20 million BC, to 10,000 BC, when we started to grow crops. For that period of history, the great enemies were malnutrition and trauma. Then once we could gather in groups through the development of agriculture, growing grasses into wheats, well, actually to make beer probably started civilization, but that kept people together. And when we could live in groups, we could transmit diseases. And that made possible these great plagues of human history. Plague itself, typhus, cholera, diphtheria, TB, the list is here on the slide. These are the scourges of mankind for most of human history. The second period started in about 1900. This is the period of bad habits. And this is where I think the diseases from which we suffered are those caused by our individual habits of behavior that are inconsistent with the human genome. That is, we weren't really programmed genetically to handle cigarette smoke, and we've only been smoking tobacco for about 400 years, a very recent period in human history, and we're maladapted to it. We don't have evolved defenses against tobacco smoke, so we die of cancers, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and arteriosclerotic vascular disease as a result of this bad habit. Same for alcohol, associated with trauma and alcoholic liver cirrhosis as causes of death. And then the high-fat, high-salt, low-fiber diet David Kessler will be discussing. We're programmed to like this because it was inaccessible in 20 million years ago. That's how our genome was evolved, in a low-sodium, low-fat, high-fiber environment. So we like the opposite. That's what we sought out. Empires were built on trading sodium, salt, because we needed it. But now that it's so accessible and it's so easy to take and we have a taste for it, it's associated with hypertension, obesity, colon cancer, and other diseases. And all of this together of modern life is associated with inanition. The people studying the Paleolithic diet estimate that Paleolithic humans burn four times as many calories per day hunting and gathering. You have to keep moving to hunt and gather. We sit and listen to talks. And so we're inactive, and that's associated with heart disease, osteoporosis, obesity, and sloth. The third phase is the enemy are us, and this is what attracted me to pulmonary medicine. I thought the next great wave of diseases would be those brought on by our collective activities, exposure to the waste products of modern industry. This was my thought as a medical student, thought I'd be a pulmonary physician or a nephrologist. We take it in and we put it out. Decided that thought the lungs were very, very interesting. This very delicate membrane to allow the uptake of oxygen had to be protected against the billions of particles we inhale every day, and more of those are from industrial products. Well, this started off in work sites, a recognition people exposed to asbestos, beryllium, mercury, mad hatters, other poisons of individual enclosed workspaces developed disease. But that spread from there to local areas like the Meuse Valley, London, Donora, Pennsylvania, where thermal inversions trapped air pollution in. In London in the 1950s, in 2 weeks of a thermal inversion when they were still burning coal, the mortality in those 2 weeks exceeded the peak of the 1917 influenza pandemic. More deaths in those 2 weeks from that air pollution crisis than from the worst 2 weeks of the influenza pandemic of 1917. And now we see whole regions covered with air pollution, the Los Angeles basin. This is not, as we like to think in the north, a function of poor moral fiber of our cousins to the south, but of a curious geography. The total amount of emissions from Los Angeles mobile sources is about a fifth of that in Houston. It's just the way the valley is constructed, trapped by the San Gabriel Mountains, that they suffer from bad air pollution. They're actually, air resources or boards are trying very hard, and the populations in general responsive. Pilots flying over Southeast Asia now refer to a toxic cloud over the whole of Southeast Asia from the rapid and unregulated development of industry. Its health effects are still a matter of speculation, but of concern. So we have these three still overlapping phases of medical history. How did we get from one to two, from unfriendly nature to bad habits as the major cause of suffering? And this is the story of the conquest of disease, the discovery of animalcules by van Leeuwenhoek looking through a microscope, the work with the famous cholera pump in London, interrupting the transmission of cholera before its causes were understood, Jenner's work, again, without really understanding quite what he was doing, enhancing protection against smallpox by vaccinating against cowpox, Pasteur's work demonstrating that microbes are living things, and Koch, who developed the postulates, Fleming, who developed penicillin, antibiotics. So these were the elements of the conquest of infectious disease. And this was so successful that some people have talked about the end of history for infectious disease. In fact, in medical school, I was advised it wasn't a good specialty. It was over. We know infectious disease were done. We knew how to conquer them. And we thought we knew that because we thought we know what an infectious disease looks like. An acute illness, acute inflammation, pain, fever, person looks sick. Transmission is obvious from person to person. It's an infectious disease. And we thought we knew how to isolate the agent by culturing it, and once we isolated it, just a matter of time before we could develop methods for detecting it, interrupting its transmission, or killing it with an antibiotic or vaccinating against its contraction. And these have been wonderfully successful. Here's some of the great success stories of medicine. Elimination of smallpox. Larry Brilliant was here last Friday night. He did great work with the Google Foundation and World Health Organization in the program that has nearly eliminated polio from the planet. Measles, rubella, mumps are well contained in countries where the population accepts the miracle of vaccination. Tuberculosis is not really controlled because a third of the world's population carries it. That's a lot of people. But it's sure better than it used to be before we knew how to culture it, how we could test for its presence by skin test, how we could treat it with antibiotics, how we could prevent transmission. We made a great difference in the treatment of TB. Vaccines aren't yet effective. There's problems with TB, and some of it's looking like it's drug resistant. But we're pretty confident we'll conquer all that. Influenza, well, we're a little worried about influenza, We know how to identify it. We know how to culture it. We know how to vaccinate against it. But it gets shifty. It keeps changing its genome. It may recombine with bird or pig sources of influenza and cause terrible disease. So we're still a little uncomfortable, and it's resistant to our antibiotics, the new strains. So, but we're confident we'll solve all that. I don't think we've paid enough attention to this amazing advance. The third most common cause of death among women from cancer on the global basis is cervical cancer. And here is a vaccine based on our understanding of the virus that prevents this cancer. I just don't think we've appreciated the significance of that advance as a general public. As for hepatitis C, HIV, AIDS, well, they're not solved, but we've isolated the virus and we're working on it. We think we're there. So, solved. End of history for infectious disease. I'm in the delusional thinking camp on this. I think this is self-deception. And the story I consider a cautionary tale is that of gastric duodenal peptic ulcers, stomach ulcers, because medicine had this so figured out with such confidence. I had them, and I know how confident my doctor was. The 1960 conceptual model of ulcers was that it was a psychosomatic disease. The other great paradigm was asthma. These are diseases where something malaligned in the psyche causes the disease in the soma. Well, there was a good story. Ulcers are associated with gastric acid hypersecretion. That's true. Acid production is increased by stimulation of the vagus nerves, which run from the brain through the lungs and airways, heart and stomach and intestines. And in animal models, stressing the animals increased acid production. And giving antacids made people feel better and helped for a while, temporarily, cure the ulcer. They were controllers. They weren't curative. Control the ulcer. So the treatment was to give drugs to neutralize the acid. This was a huge market. This was a medicine-pharmacy collaboration. In fact, I don't know what would have happened to the pharmacy industry if we hadn't been persuaded that GERD is just as important and we'd eat antacids, because that's a giant market. That's another story. So we gave drugs to neutralize or decrease the production of acid, and we instructed our patients to eat non-acidic foods. Mashed potatoes were good, milk, soft-boiled eggs, really awful stuff, and to chill out. Don't turn stressing inward. So I was told I was turning my stressing inward. I thought I was a pretty well-adjusted guy, but knew better because these experts were telling me. And then Robin Warren and Barry Marshall from Australia, although Barry worked at the University of Virginia, thought otherwise. Robin kept noticing in the gastric folds these things that look like bacteria. Well, people knew those were just bacteria that people had eaten and that the acid in the stomach is way too acidic for bacteria to grow, so that was dismissed. But then Barry Marshall cultured them, and he cultured them in a very acidic environment. These bacteria needed an acidic environment to grow. Once he was able to culture it, the story began to change. He could demonstrate transmission. He drank a slurry of Helicobacter pylori and developed acute severe gastritis. Fortunately, he also demonstrated the effectiveness of antibiotic treatment. He was able to cure himself. And now this treatment, 3 weeks of an antibiotic, sometimes with bismuth, is curative for repeated gastrointestinal hemorrhage from ulcer disease. So one of the most common causes of hospital admission is now an uncommon cause of hospital admission. Again, I don't think we've appreciated this. A chronic disease causing great suffering and expense was transformed by the recognition of the importance of a microbe. Now, my mother used to read me cautionary poems, and I know that we're supposed to take morals from cautionary stories. So what are the morals, or what are the lessons of this cautionary tale? First of all, here's an infectious disease that didn't have an acute phase, where person-to-person transmission is not obvious, where there was a plausible alternate theory for pathogenesis, and the bacterium was hard to culture. But once it could be cultured, then medicine began to change its views from hostile skepticism to giving them the Nobel Prize in 2005 for medicine. So here are the morals. Nature has more subtle and mysterious ways of being unfriendly than we had thought. Infection may be important in chronic inflammatory diseases that we attribute to other causes. I think this is very likely true of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, asthma, maybe rheumatoid arthritis, maybe pulmonary fibrosis, maybe multiple sclerosis, maybe diabetes. I think the list is a long one. We think we know. I think the words autoimmune and idiopathic ought to be statements preceded or defined as a synonym for ignorance. We're saying we don't know what really causes this when we use those terms. They're pseudo-assurances. So maybe what we need is a better method for detecting microbes. What methods have we been using? Here are the methods for detecting microbes in a clinical sample. We can culture it. We can use antibodies against a microbe that are labeled, or then look at the tissues and see if the microbe's there. Or we can look for antibodies in the patient's serum against the microbes. Or we can do something called polymerase chain reaction, where we look for a particular genetic sequence unique to that microbe. All but the first of these requires that we know what we're looking for to develop the tools to look for it. There's only one unbiased method, a 19th century method in the 21st medical practice, 21st century practice, and that's to culture. There are actually new methods, deep sequencing, which is going to get a little beyond what I'm talking about, but they're 21st, and I'm going to talk about 21st century method. This is what we've relied on. Now, we know that not all microbes grow on just anything, and we do use different culture media. Here are three different kinds of culture plates, different nutrients in them. And we add a clinical sample, and these things might grow. We might grow Pseudomonas or Clostridium or E. coli or Staphylococcus or Strep or so forth. There's like Salmonella. We'll grow one of those, and we can recognize them from the way they look on those culture plates. But what if they just don't want to grow on the plates we put out there? What do we do then? Well, we're sort of ignorant. And this took such a long time. You think this would have been earlier. 1985, Staley and colleagues looked at some pond water. They took a drop of pond water and said, gee, I see thousands of organisms in this water that look different one from the other. But when I culture them, I get a few organisms, and these different on your right, many of those are the same bacterium. So I'm only finding about 1% of the number of different-looking bacteria I think I should be finding. This is called the great plate anomaly. When we plate out the water onto a culture plate, we grow a very small fraction of the diversity of bacteria we think we should be growing. Well, now we know that many bacteria don't grow on standard culture media. Different nutritional requirements, different oxygen requirements. Some bacteria can only grow if other bacteria are around. Dentists have actually known this for a long time. And some bacteria just won't grow if they're stressed. So these problems for bacteria are even graver for viruses. Here's some examples. Rhinovirus, the most common of human infections, 2 to 12 a year for an adult or a child, colds from rhinoviruses. Wasn't even cultured until 1950. Once it was cultured and we can develop molecular methods for detecting it, we recognized that we could culture it only 15% of the time we knew it was there in samples from people with respiratory infections. And from work that I've very recently been involved in with Joe DeRisi here at Mission Bay, we've discovered a third branch previously unknown of rhinovirus, now recognized by several labs around the country, that no one has succeeded in culturing. We've only identified it through molecular virological techniques. And rhinovirus group C seems to cause more severe disease than the other rhinoviruses, makes babies sicker. In fact, many of their infections were presumed to be respiratory syncytial virus. It's a rhinovirus. It's just a much worse one than we thought because it had never been cultured, still hasn't been. HIV took a long time to culture. Many labs, Jay Levy actually could have been on the list with I was at Luc Montagnier for the Nobel Prize for discovery of that virus. And then, because it was hard to culture, half the people who in California die of what for all the world looks like acute viral encephalitis die of unknown cause because we can't culture anything from their spinal fluid. It's hard to reproduce in a lab the very selective conditions of a neural cell to permit a virus to grow. So viruses are even worse than bacteria. So we need a better mouse trap for microbes. We need a better way of finding them. So here comes your primer on molecular. You've had the history of medicine. Now it's molecular biology. So this is an 18-unit lecture. DNA, of course, is unique for each individual. Little differences there. And unique for each species. Differences are greater among the members of the species, but as you go up from species to genus to family, class, phyla, kingdom, the differences in DNA get greater and greater. So when we look here at the tree of life, and I have to point something out to you.
Here we humans are with the animals, pretty close to slime molds. But we're far away from bacteria. So actually, our DNA is very different from bacterial DNA. And you think we should be able to exploit that to find bacterial DNA in samples obtained from people.
And that's the essence of what I want to talk about, methods that exploit that difference. How do we exploit it? Well, a little bit on molecular biology. There are four nucleotides in DNA, adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, shown here. And they always pair in a certain way. Okay? Adenine always with thymidine, cytosine with guanine, always pair. So they, and DNA exists in two strands that are like two halves of a zipper or pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. One strand is exactly complementary to the other. That's useful because it enables us to make copies through something called the polymerase chain reaction.
I'm going to shout again because I'm away from the microphone. Here's two strands of DNA locked together. If we heat it to almost boiling temperature, they'll come apart. Now we can work with them. If we make a template, we know the strand at the beginning, the sequence at the beginning of this piece of DNA, and at the end, and add a polymerase and a reverse polymerase, it will start at these ends and just make copies. Heat, separate, add some stuff, cool, and make copies. Heat again, separate, add the polymerase, cool, take more. So you start with 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. And after 24 cycles, you have millions of strands of DNA to work with. Okay, so what you need is a piece of DNA, something in bacterial DNA, whose sequence we know at both ends, and that's different in the middle among different bacteria.
And what great good fortune there is such a place. It's the gene for ribosomal RNA. Now, we all need, everything that lives needs to make proteins, and proteins are made in the ribosomes. That's where the genetic code is transmitted to this construction of a protein, that very essential thing. So everything needs to do this. And the gene for ribosomal RNA of almost everything that lives has constant regions. This is so important that once nature figured it out, it didn't change it very much.
So these are your constant regions of this gene for ribosomal RNA. The sequences in between here are different for different kinds of life and different for different bacteria.
So
here's a constant region. You're making the template. That's what you want. And here are those constant regions. This is where we make templates to. And so we can copy everything from one end to the other. Then we just have to figure out
what it is. So, better mousetrap depends on taking advantage of this gene. We make many copies of the gene for ribosomal RNA using the PCR reaction. And then we just have to analyze the product. And here's another wonderful, nature so kind to us sometimes, wonderful fact. The gene for ribosomal RNA of bacteria is less dense than the gene for ribosomal RNA in people. So we've made many copies of something. We don't know what it is, but we put it on a gel to measure its density. If it's 18S, well, it may be human. If it's 16S, that's Svedborg units, it's a density unit, Swedish guy. If it's 16S, it ain't human. It's not. Something in your sample had a gene for ribosomal RNA, and it wasn't a human thing. It was a bacterial thing. So that's brilliant. It's so easy. You take your sample, extract the DNA, do the PCR for the gene for ribosomal RNA, measure the density of your product, and if it contains 16S density, some of it's 16S, it separates out on a density gel, it's bacterial. Now you can work with that. Well, how do you work with that? How do you figure out the sequence of that? Well, you can analyze the sequence. Actually, can be done. It's just very expensive, tedious, and time-consuming. There's a neater way to do it. And this slide was made for me by Catherine's husband, Bob. So acknowledgments given royalties to be paid later. So here's a strand of DNA. Are you ready? Let's see if I can get this to work. All right. Here's a strand of DNA. Two strands. I'm heating it up. When you heat them up, they come apart. Okay, now we're just looking at one strand of DNA. Spotlight's on the center part there. Let's just pause it there. It's so beautiful. See the nucleotides align this chain. Now just imagine I took this chain and fixed it on a glass slide. And now I've made something. I've made a lot of something. I don't know what it is, but it's a piece of DNA. And I labeled it with a dye. And then I added it. So I have thousands of spots of different sequences of DNA, and I know what I put in each spot on my glass slide. I take my unknown product that I've labeled, and I add it. And it will float around, and it will find its complement. And when it finds its complement, the other half of its zipper, it'll stick. It'll zipper up. And it'll light it up because I put a label on it. And that's the principle of a microarray. A microarray has thousands of strands of DNA. On each spot, they're all exactly the same. And we know what we got those strands from at each spot. We take our unknown sample with a label, add it to the microarray, and look for where it hybridizes. That's what this is called. It's called hybridization. Just amazing. It is so cool. So just to review, so we put on the glass surface. There's some real experts on this in the audience, and I want them to be kind. You know what I'm talking about. So you put on the surface known sequences of DNA. You know this one's from Salmonella, and this one's from Shigella, and so forth. They're just stuck on them, but there are thousands of them on each spot. Then you've labeled your product with a fluorescent dye. You put it over your glass slide, and
where it hybridizes and you have a spot, you know something in your sample was complementary to whatever you put right there.
And that's the principle of a microarray. Now, this tool was developed for analyzing differences in human genes. I think it was brilliant of people to think we could use this tool to detect bacteria in human samples. That's what happened. And the PhyloChip was developed at Lawrence Berkeley National Labs by our cousins across the bay. It has 500,000 probes on a chip the size of a thumbnail that will detect 30,000 taxa. A taxa is a cluster of up to 16 bacteria with very similar sequences in the gene for ribosomal RNA. That's what it looks like. And when you have something that hybridizes on this spot on the chip, that red one you see?
That's a really good match. That's quite a good match. So something in the sample must have been the same as whatever was put on that spot because it hybridized right there.
So here's how it works.
You extract your DNA from a clinical sample. You amplify, you take out the DNA, amplify for the gene for ribosomal RNA, and measure its density. This is a gel. If it settles at 16S, it's not human, it's bacterial. Take your amplicon code, label it, apply it to a chip, and where the label fragments find their mates, they will stick right there. You put it in the computer, which scans it, compares it to the genome for all known bacteria, and prints out your findings.
And this method will find not just the most dominant, but all of them. And in a stool sample, for example, we might find 1,200 bacteria. So it's a fabulous tool, and it's been recognized as one. It got the award from Research and Development magazine, and I like it that the Wall Street Journal gave it the bronze medal of the top 100. But what they're proudest of is it made Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Is that?
Now, this was developed with funding from the Department of Energy. The purpose of this was to explore toxic waste sites, oil spills, uranium mines, air intake duct to the Senate office building, places where we suspect bad microbes might be found. And it was Owen Brody and Sue Lynch who had the wit to say, we should use this to look at clinical samples as well. It's really the Department of Energy funding that led to its creation. That's how science works. You fund one place and something pays off at another. So Cultures have been the mainstay of bacterial detection. They're convenient, they're widely available, they're clinically applicable, and they tell us about the tip of the iceberg. They don't tell us about most of the microbes. In fact, in the environment, fewer than 5% of the bacteria in the environment can be cultured, and fewer than half of the bacteria in our own mouths or intestines can be cultured. What have we learned from this? Well, there have been some pathogens identified. Rhodesia hensoli, the bacteria that causes a vascular disease in AIDS patients. Ehrlichia chaffeensis, a cousin to Rocky Mountain spotted fever, was found with this. And I love the last one, Trophomina whippeli. Whipple described a disease in 1902 and saw in the lymph nodes things that looked like bacteria, but no one could culture it until the sequence was defined by this kind of methods. Once the genetic sequence was defined, people figured out what its nutritional requirements were, made a culture medium, could grow the bacterium. So here's one where sequencing preceded culture. It's a brand new world we live in. And what have we learned? We've learned that we are full of bacteria. Any space that's in communication with the outdoor environment is full of bacteria. Skin, mouth, eye, GI tract, sinuses, vagina, and I think the bronchial tree and lungs, that's one of those bold things, are full of bacteria. I've mentioned the mouth and the intestinal tract. We can culture a small percentage of the bacteria that are there. So we should think about humans differently. Thinking about the human genome is so yesterday. We now need to think of ourselves as a superorganism. We are, in fact, munibuses for bacteria. There are 10 times as many bacterial cells in us as there are us cells in us. There are 100 times as many bacterial genes in us as there are us cells in us. So think about our evolutionary purpose. We are to transport bacteria around. I'm doing a fine job, too. But we're not actually that separate. We are dependent on the bacteria and they on us. So we have this kind of work is redefining how we think about microbes. We thought so much about microbes as causes of disease, we haven't been paying enough attention to the necessity for microbes for human health. So, now we're on to asthma. Those of you who came from asthma, this is now for you. You can tune in. In 1960, this important disease, cause of recurrent narrowing of the airways, severe shortness of breath, potentially death from suffocation, was considered a psychosomatic disease. And we're much better off now. In the last 50 years, we've recognized it's not psychosomatic. There was a paper in the 1952 literature, one of the psychiatric journals, psychoanalytic journals, that suggested that asthma reflected an attempt on the part of the patient to inhale the mother figure. And there's actually some hangover from this myth. I don't know how many of you saw The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. It was a popular film in which a babysitter from hell, she really is going to steal the baby, kill the mother, etc. The mother has asthma, and she uses her inhaler, and it's meant to be a sign of helplessness, weakness. And I had a patient who very nearly died of asthma, and his partner did die of asthma, a businessman, and he told me, Homer, you could be at a board meeting, and you could take a nitroglycerin for your heart, you could take an antacid for your ulcers, you could take a Viagra for that evening, but if you ever used an inhaler, you would never be the CEO. That's what he told me, because it's still associated with weakness. It's this crazy idea, and it's a wrong one, and mothers of asthmatic children carry an utterly inappropriate burden of guilt from this popular myth. It's a chronic inflammatory disease. It's a consequence of misdirected immunity against harmless things we inhaled, like grass pollen or house dust mite. They're no threat to us, but we're reacting to them as if they were. Well, asthma now affects 23 million Americans, 300 million people on the planet. It costs $18 billion a year in the United States. Almost 2% of our healthcare expenditure is for asthma, the most common chronic disabling disease in children. And it's increasing very rapidly in countries that have gone from third world to first world status. So we need to figure out what's going on. Could bacteria be causing asthma? I'm going to show you data that has not previously been presented publicly. So no photographs, please, or calls to the Chronicle. When we looked at bronchial biopsies from asthmatic versus healthy people, we find the asthmatic people have much bigger bacterial burdens in their airways. That's what's shown. This is the quantity of 16S in 250,000 cells obtained by bronchial brushing from healthy and asthmatic people. Okay? Among the asthmatics, when we classified them,
according to how sensitive their airways are, healthy airways are insensitive to inhaled things. The low, mild asthma, and the severe asthma, very sensitive airways. Progressive increase in the bacterial burden and the diversity of bacteria.
And we are starting to look at specific bacterial candidates. We don't yet know which. We have our ideas which ones are important, but we're not positive. Well, what about infants' asthma and microarrays? Well, here I'm going to argue that microbes are important in protection against asthma. So there's been a great increase in asthma's prevalence over the last 50 years. Its greatest, highest prevalence is in the developed world, and it's not air pollution. That's the first instinct. The country with the highest mortality from asthma on the planet is New Zealand, which is hardly an industrial giant of air pollution. The most rapid rate of increase is in the developing world. Third world has very low rates of allergy and asthma, but as they adopt a Western lifestyle, it goes up steeply. And in those societies, it increases in each birth cohort. It's something we're doing to our infants that seems to be important. Well, here's some curious epidemiologic findings. Asthma and allergies are less likely in infants who have been breastfed by a non-allergic asthmatic mother for 6 months, who have older siblings, the more the better, who grow up on a farm with domestic animals, especially pigs, who drink unpasteurized farm milk, chancy thing. But if it's very clean, it's safe, and it's much used drunk in Europe, and the kids who drink it have lower rates of allergy and asthma, and who grow up in the underdeveloped world or Eastern Europe. And what's so interesting about those European studies is genetically similar populations, Swedes and Estonians, have quite different rates of allergy and asthma. Everything east of the Iron Curtain has much lower rates of allergy and asthma than the societies west of the Iron Curtain. That astounded us when they finally let us, Erica von Mucius, do the studies, because it was opposite to our expectation. So other curious epidemiologic studies. Someone had the idea to culture, use some of these new methods, nothing as powerful as the phylochip, but methods to look at diaper samples from 1 month olds. And in the third world, where allergies and asthma are very uncommon, the diapers are full of lactobacilli and bifidobacteria. In the first world, they're full of clostridia and coliforms. In Eastern versus Western Europe, same finding. And this prospective study of nearly 1,000 Dutch babies, diapers sampled at 1 month of age and followed to the age of two, the more coliforms and the more clostridia in the diaper in a dose-dependent way, the higher was the rate of eczema and allergic sensitization in the babies. Well, that's an epidemiologic study. It's an observational association. It doesn't prove causation. An interventional trial was done by a husband-wife team, the Kaliomakis in Finland, and they showed that feeding lactobacillus casei, very high doses of a common yogurt bacillus, to babies with allergic parents reduced the rates of eczema at age two by 50%. That's an astounding figure. It has not been reproduced consistently. Some studies have shown, however, that feeding yogurt bacilli improves eczema in babies who have it. Michael Cabana is pursuing this study with NIH funding at UCSF. He's enrolling 300 newborns from the Bay Area with an asthmatic parent. Half are being fed lactobacilli every day for the first 6 months of life, half placebo. And the goal is to compare rates of allergy and asthma at age three and six. So I talked to Michael. I said, Michael, have you been saving stool samples from those babies? He said, oh, sure. We want to see that the mothers are actually giving them lactobacillus. And I said, well, could we look at some? And he gave us 16 samples from six-month-olds. This is a blind study. I don't know which kids got lactobacillus and which got placebo. And we analyzed. They were in the freezer, minus 80 degrees, by phylochip. And not surprisingly, all the diaper samples had bacteria in them. 100% had a 16S signal. And the bacteria, we found about 1,200 different types, were what we expected in stool samples. The Firmicutes, the Bacteroidetes, Actinobacteria, just what you'd expect. But then when we looked at, by a non-hierarchical statistical method, just clustered, how do things cluster if you look at relatedness of populations? There were two quite distinct groups. And one group, the red ones, had lots of Clostridia. The other group had lots of Bifidobacteria and Lactobacilli, the blue bacteria. In fact, they look reciprocal. The more Lactobacilli you have, the less Clostridia. The more Clostridia you have, the fewer Lactobacilli. As if these bacterial populations are competitive. They inhibit each other. So what we don't know is whether
these babies won't get allergies and these will. But that's what we're trying to find out.
Because if we can find that out, identify the bacteria, and then figure out what it is about them that's signaling the immune system to develop differently, we might develop a preventive approach to treating asthma. Here's another fascinating study. Growing up with pets, dogs and cats, protects against asthma. This is what keeps us physicians humble. Because 20 years ago, I would have said, in fact, told my own son, can't have a cat, can't have a dog, we have an allergic history. Should have had two dogs in the house, right? In fact, two dogs is worth one older brother. I had two older brothers. If someone had told me I could swap one for two dogs, I don't know. So anyway, I want to talk about this slide. This shows the percentage of children allergic to dog, to cat, to outdoor allergens, you know, grass, ragweed, tree, pollens, indoor allergens, house dust mite, cockroach, atopy, which is defined by an illness, or that's by skin testing, and seroATP is by antibodies, allergic antibodies against specific allergen. Note that having one dog or one cat protects children against being allergic from dog or cat. Having two protects them a little more. But here's what's astounding. Having one dog or cat doesn't protect you much against outdoor allergies or indoor allergies, but having two does. In other words, growing up with two dogs or two cats from birth doesn't just reduce the risk of being allergic to dog or cat, but to anything else. So what's that about? So these people did this study. This is called the Wheel Study. It was done in Detroit. So they dropped by a poster we were presenting, and we said, let's figure this out. So they gave us, they were collecting house dust samples from these houses when these babies, they're now 6 years old, when they were very small. And we studied the house dust. And we found that the house dust from the households with pets had more bacteria of greater diversity than the house dust samples from the households with no pets. Now humans for a long time have grown up with animals around. It's pretty recent that we've separated ourselves from domestic animals. So our speculation is maybe that household flora, what's in the dust, shapes intestinal flora. Babies are always putting things in their mouths. And then maybe intestinal flora shapes immune function. And there's increasing evidence that exposure to microbes is necessary for the induction of a healthy immune function. And conceivably, the intestinal flora is modifiable by feeding. And it could be that modern diets are encouraging, providing nutrients for a different kind of microbial. Maybe corn syrup provokes the growth of different bacteria from sugar or from breast milk. Maybe the changes in diet are having consequences we haven't thought of, haven't recognized. Well, what is this immune function to protect us against? Here's where I turn to viruses. The COE study done by collaborators at the University of Wisconsin followed 300 children with an allergic parent now to age 6. They know which of these children developed asthma and which did not. And they saw those children every 2 months in the first year of life and whenever they were ill. And they found that the strongest predictor of being an asthmatic 6-year-old is to have become sick from a cold virus in the first year of life. So this shows the proportion of children who have asthma at age 6 who did not get a wheezing illness with a cold in the first year of life, who had a wheezing illness from the worst of the viruses, respiratory syncytial virus, 3 times more likely. But of those who got sick from rhinovirus, the standard cold virus, 9 to 10-fold increase in the odds ratio of being an asthmatic 6-year-old. To get sick from a rhinovirus in the first year of life is a strong predictor of being an asthmatic 6-year-old. Okay, that's an association. Maybe this virus just makes everybody sick. It's so powerful, so it doesn't discriminate. It's only the kids who are pre-asthmatic who get sick with rhinovirus. It's an association. This is just scratching off the lottery ticket. Doesn't mean rhinovirus is causing asthma. But then Tina Hartert at Vanderbilt did this fabulous study. She examined the relationship between the week of birth and whether a child was an asthmatic 5-year-old. And she didn't just look at the week of birth. She looked at the relationship, the interval between the week of birth and the peak week of viruses in the winter season when the most were reported to the public health authorities. So between 1990 and 95, she identified 95,000 babies from medical records born to 10 care. That's Medi-Cal for Tennessee. And she calculated the interval in each year between the birth week and the peak week for winter viruses. And that wobbles 2 to 4 weeks on either side of mid-February. So she corrected it for each year. And then she looked at the database for those kids 5 years later to see if they were getting medications for asthma or had been to the emergency department for asthma. What did she find? She found that the odds ratio of having asthma are highest, almost 1.30, 30% higher, for children who are born 4 months before the peak week of winter viruses. What's that about 4 months? Maternal antibodies are low. Infant immune function is not well developed. The sum of those is at its lowest ebb at about this age. So you don't want to have your baby in November. You want to have your baby in May or June so the child is a healthier, more mature, immune from the immune standpoint, baby at the peak of the winter virus season. So, okay, that's 1990 babies. What if in the third world they're exposed to greater microbial burden, which causes a more rapid development of immune function? Maybe this curve is flattened in those babies. The study hasn't been done, but experiments in mice shows that mice raised in a germ-free environment die badly from influenza infection. If you feed them lactobacillus, the littermates, they have much better defense against influenza infection at age 12 weeks. So what do we think is going on? Here's a diagram as to what we think is going on. We think gut microbiota, the bacteria in the gut, shape immune development. We think the gut microbiota are influenced by the microbiota, the bacteria in the household environment. And that's affected by SIBs, PETs, pests, dampness. It's also affected by diet, antibiotic treatment, and maternal vaginal flora. Babies born by C-section have a higher rate of asthma at age 6 than babies born by vaginal delivery. They've missed out on transmission of maternal microbes. And breast milk is full of microbes. There are no lactobacilli, healthy ones. So we believe that these are the influences on gut microbiota, which shapes immune development, which shapes the response to allergens and viruses, which then shapes the risk of developing an allergies and asthma. That's sort of a big picture idea. So what are we doing with this? Well, we're collaborating. I haven't talked about the virochip. It's like the phylochip, but it's for viruses instead of bacteria. We're working with Rob Lemansky at Wisconsin. We're getting samples from those babies. He saved them when they were sick and wheezing in the first year of life. So we can see what's different about those viruses associated with later asthma from those viruses not associated with later asthma. And we're using the phylochip to look at house dust samples and diaper samples from infants in large cohort studies. And the one I'm most excited about is the inner city allergy asthma study, because very high rates of allergy and asthma in inner city America. This has always been thought to be the weakness in the hygiene hypothesis. If being too clean is the problem, why are allergies and asthma so high in the inner city? I think it's the wrong microbes. I think it's the nature of the microbes, not just the number of them, that's important. So the big idea is that immune function is inducible, not predetermined, and the window for shaping it is early in life, that exposure to the microbial world is necessary for the development of a balanced immune system. Kids should be outdoors in the dirt playing. Don't go outside and don't come home till lunch. That's the instruction. The gastrointestinal tract is a key site for shaping immune development. That's where we learn to distinguish the proteins we need for nutrition, to survive, from the enemies. It's a very important organ for immune function. And this is this idea that delayed maturation of immune function from living in small families, in very clean households, in modern wealthy America, prolongs the window of vulnerability to infection with one of these pro-asthmatic viruses. And maybe to viruses that predispose to other diseases, like MS, like pulmonary fibrosis, like diabetes. I think the list is conceivably long. I know I'm speculating, everybody. And if we can figure out the signals that stimulate immune development, then we can learn how to manipulate them by more effective means and actually develop a logical science-based approach to asthma prevention. So, review here. The era of infectious disease may not be over. New methods based on the search for microbial genes may enable discovery of new microbial pathogens, things we don't know about yet. These new methods are already providing new clues to the causes of disease, and these new methods are also providing clues in the role of microbial exposure in the development of immune function in early infants. The big conclusion here is that there's more to heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our philosophy. I'm just so impressed with how often physicians and scientists get trapped by the limitations of their own technology. If culture didn't show it, must not be infectious. I just hear that so often. It's just not true. We believe too much in our tools. We're not open enough to the possibilities that there's more to heaven and earth than we've dreamt of. So I have hoped I've stimulated you to dream a little bit of in our philosophies. If you'd like to help, if you have asthma or know somebody with asthma, have a family member with asthma, there's no animal model for this disease. And the only way we can figure out whether the science is relevant is by examining people with the condition. We're terribly careful with them because we regard them as heroes and heroines of modern science. If you'd like to give support, give to the America Asthma Foundation, which was founded by the Sandler Family Foundation, or, you know, directly to my research by going to the UCSF Foundation. So with that, let me thank you for your attention this evening. It's been a great pleasure to speak here at the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you, Dr. Boucher, for a very interesting, very stimulating talk. I got a few research ideas myself. Now we'll have Adria pass the microphone around the audience, unless you want to just put it on a stand. We'll try it on a stand. Just if you want to ask a question, come up to the microphone, and we have 5 or 10 minutes for questions. Well, I'll ask the first question then. What about the role of vitamin D in fighting viruses and bacteria?
If you know Bill, you know he's going to ask about vitamin D, so I was ready for him. It's very interesting. The site that the virus infects the airway is the airway epithelial cell. And Maudlin and colleagues at UCLA demonstrated that the epithelial cell expresses the vitamin D receptor. And stimulation of that receptor by vitamin D causes the production of molecules that are innate antiviral, antibacterial proteins. It's a natural antibiotic, so to speak. And we have known for a long time that kids with rickets get bad respiratory tract infections. So there's increasing evidence that vitamin D deficiency may be associated with higher rates of asthma and with worse asthma in people who have it. What hasn't been done yet is to show that intervening by giving people with asthma vitamin D improves their condition. But I'm now recommending it. I'm going ahead of the science because I think we need vitamin D is not really a food vitamin. It shouldn't even be called a vitamin. It should be called a pro-hormone. You should give this part of the talk. And you get it from sunlight exposure, but we spend 90% of our time indoors now, modern humans, and we get it from sunlight. And so we need to, if we aren't in the sun, we need to supplement ourselves. Shiitake mushrooms, oily fish, or a capsule. Come on, it's very cheap, easy, and absolutely safe. 1,000 to 2,000 units a day. It's a very good idea. Thank you, Bill. I've got one behind you, sorry. It doesn't well. And your observation is a good one. It's an important one. I'm not sure that childhood asthma is the same thing as adult onset asthma. Asthma in children is a disease of boys. Adult onset asthma is a disease of women. And it's usually more severe asthma. And it's harder to treat. It's often associated with aspirin sensitivity as well. Taking an aspirin tablet causes asthma to become much worse. A study done in Poland of women with aspirin-sensitive asthma found evidence of chronic rhinovirus infection in 10 of 10 women. Now, the methods weren't perfect, so it's a controversial paper. But maybe, and there's a great, the second peak of asthma is around the menopause, around age 50. It's in women. We don't actually understand the role of how sex hormones shape the presentation of asthma. It's, of course, always difficult to generalize from one person's individual experience. I've been talking about statistical associations here. But your point's a good one. I'm not sure that adult onset asthma in women is the same creature as asthma in children. Catherine, you want to make a comment?
Sorry, just had to jump in. One thing that you might want to know about is that if we were to take 100 people who considered themselves healthy off the street and tested them for sensitivity to what we call aeroallergens, dust mite, cat, dog, pollens, many people would have positive tests even though they have no allergies or physical manifestations, obvious symptoms. What we think is probably happening is that many of the people who have the positive tests later on actually develop the symptoms, so that it may be that the immune system recognizes some of these things, but the symptoms don't actually come until later. And this is one of the things that is being studied in the allergy immunology literature. So it could be that you had sensitivity for many years, but the symptoms of it don't really develop until later on.
Are you taking vitamin D?
Yes.
Good. Okay. I will get to you, I promise. Yes.
I have two questions, and thank you for this brilliant, lucid presentation. I've heard
thank you
talk at UCSF quarter several times, and you're always so highly regarded by the students and residents. When I have two questions. The first is there a viral resident flora equivalent to the bacterial resident flora, and is anyone exploring that?
That's a great question, and I hope the answer is going to be yes, because today we had to turn in our applications for the challenge grant from the NIH. This is part of the America Recovery Act. NIH is giving out $200 million for 100 new research grants. And one of them was to define the microbiome of the airway. And I put in one this morning for bacteria and another one with colleagues for viruses, because we believe there may be a viral microbiome to the airways. No one has thought that to be true. But actually, it's conceivable that there is a viral microbiome. The answer is no, there isn't, but maybe there is. and we need to figure it out.
Yeah, the second is the relationship between asthma and eczema, and they're frequently related, and they target two extremely different organs.
Right. Asthma and eczema run together. They're both allergic diseases, both diseases associated with allergy. And in people with asthma who have eczema, generally have more severe asthma. They respond worse to inhaled allergens. And as you control the eczema with topical corticosteroids, the asthma actually improves. So there's an association that we don't wholly understand, but they're both manifestations of the same basic misdirected immune response. And both cause the same kind, well, not exactly the same kind, but both cause a characteristic inflammation, one in the lungs and one in the skin. So there's some association, and I guess I've said what I can say about it. Now, you had a question.
I did, and thank you. It is brilliant. I really enjoyed what you had to say. And you talked about identifying as like fingerprints, I guess, when you're looking at these RNAs. And the question I had was your phylo test, would that certainly identify what's human and what's not? But on the tree of life, you have fungus and so forth like humans. And how do you control for other factors like fungus or heavy metals or other factors that might cause asthma as well?
Okay, I can't go to heavy metals right here. But you're right. Bacteria are further from us than fungi are. And Lawrence Berkeley is developing the microchip. It's going to use a different part of the gene, not for ribosomal RNA, but for something else to distinguish microbial gene sequences from human gene sequences. So we, with the phylo chip, we don't know if there's fungal gene there or not, because it'll settle out with the 18S band. We're going to miss it. Heavy metals is another story entirely. And when you use the term fingerprinting, you're actually very astute, because the term for identifying which TB, tuberculosis, was spread from one person to another, they called that DNA fingerprinting. It's an old term. It's a little out of fashion. But it was once the term used for this, just exactly this. Final question.
Okay. I want to thank you for coming out tonight. I think this is a great presentation.
My pleasure.
I'm a senior citizen. I'm over 86. And I've got very good health care. I've got veterans and I've got Kaiser. And my mind has never been younger, but I also have a condition. It's not asthma. It's chronic fatigue. I'm just so exhausted. We haven't been able to connect it to anything yet. And I'm just wondering if your research would explore that area of chronic fatigue.
Well, the great advantage of asthma and lung disease is we can access the organ that's affected. We can put a bronchoscope down and get samples. We can take little biopsies. The trouble with chronic fatigue syndrome is we don't know quite what to sample. Should we be sampling muscle? Should we be sampling brain? Should we be sampling lymph tissue? When you start looking for organisms in, the nice thing, again, about the lungs for, say, viruses and bacteria, we get very pure populations of cells, so the background noise isn't such a problem because we know what to subtract out. Blood is a very complicated fluid, and it's harder to work. Actually, are working with these methods to detect microbes in blood. Actually, blood banks are very interested in them. And maybe those tools will show a virus or a bacteria associated with chronic fatigue syndrome. So far, no agent has been identified. It's a great mystery. But I think these are the kind of tools that will solve it.
So my question is, are you based in San Francisco, and should I possibly be trying to get some tests with you and work with you?
Okay. Forgive me for saying this. We do have some interest in immunosenescence. How does immune function change with aging? And we have a fellow who's actually recruiting volunteers for a study of immunosenescence. So I'll give you my card so we can see about setting up an appointment.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think a lot of your audience is probably very strongly science-based, and I'm only partially so. Forgive the comment if it's a little basic, but I am a health and wellness counselor, and I find that a neti pot goes an incredible distance for people with allergies, colds, sinus infections, and asthma. So I recommend it almost like brushing their teeth to use it every night. The second thing I find, again, from the basic non-science point of view, is that when I can increase somebody's glutathione, I find their inflammation goes down, I find their energy increases. And I've been able to do that in a fairly benign way, and it's been tested with blood results. If you were able to get me to understand most of that, that's a miracle. Thank you.
I think Homer handed me the microphone for the neti pot part of it. In the allergy immunology clinic, usually one of the first things that we recommend for people who are having ongoing symptoms is saline irrigation. The neti pot is literally a teapot that you use to pour a saline or salt water solution in one side going out the other. But there are actually systems now that are designed for the nose so that you can actually just literally squirt some saline, and it goes up one side, out the other. And we recommend this for almost everyone, with the exception of a few people who are either immunodeficient or who've had sinus surgery that shouldn't be squirting things up their nose. But it can be very beneficial for people who have allergic rhinitis, recurrent sinus problems, and a host of upper respiratory and lower respiratory disorders. So it's right at the top of the list of things that we recommend as something that can be tried that's quite innocuous and potentially quite beneficial. We don't really have good scientific studies for it, but and not everybody likes to squirt water up their nose, but for the right person, it's very, very helpful. And yes.
Yeah, and the nice thing about the neti pot is it's portable. It's $25. You can take it everywhere, and all you have to do is add salt. Yeah, I don't like plastic.
Okay. Our thanks to Professor Homer Boucher for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening on the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.